You're listening to Screen Heroes on the Heroes Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome back to Screen Heroes, your film and TV podcast on the Heroes Podcast Network. This is episode 231. I am your regular host, Derek, and I have with me my two lovely longtime co-hosts, Ryan.
Hello.
And Ray.
Hello. And hello. I brought along Grogu.
In a sense, you have. Yeah, we've got our baby with us this evening. And so if you hear baby-like noises,
it's Grogu.
Either you're welcome or we're sorry. One of the two, depending on how you're feeling about it.
Yeah, there's different categories you may fall into there. So I don't want to, you know, pigeonhole anybody. So this week, what are we doing? What are we talking about? We are closing out our 3 weeks of Merry Cagemas with the film Face Off. Before that, we've got some news we're going to cover in the entertainment industry. And then we will close out this week by discussing the season 2 finale of The Mandalorian in all of its spoilery goodness. So that's
the plan. Should we pause this for a second and say that you're on the Star Trek Dude page and not the Screen Heroes page?
I am on both pages.
I just wanted to make sure that we were good. That's the one that popped up in my feed. And if it was wrong, I wanted to fix it before we got too deep into this.
So normally, I appreciate that. Normally, we live stream this just in our Screen Heroes forum group on Facebook, but I decided to do it on our public page. And it turns out that that's changed a bit since we've done it last, and you can now cross post. So we are live on Heroes Podcast Network, on my Star Trek Dude page, and on Dorico Studios, which is the company that owns the Heroes Podcast Network. So there you go.
Okay. Sorry.
And we're also in the group too, I think. So that's all the ways you can find us if you want to watch us live. It is all on Facebook. That's how you have to watch us live. But there you go. That's it. All right, so news. Let's talk news. We've got two main stories, I think, that we're going to cover. We have a third that we'll talk about during the Star Wars segment. The first being She-Hulk news. So we got some casting information about She-Hulk last week when Disney had its massive announcement of stuff. But we got a little bit more. And Ray, why don't you tell us what it is? Because I know you have a strong opinion.
I don't have a strong opinion.
Never.
So She-Hulk is going to be a half-hour legal comedy. And it sounds like this is going to be more like the more recent comic lines than her early days that were done, late 70s and 80s. So She-Hulk has had kind of a tumultuous run of comics. They're never quite as successful as the Hulk stuff, but she is a very interesting character. She will completely break the fourth wall and talk directly to the audience, and she started doing this before Deadpool. Just want to get that out there. But she's also a prosecutor, and she's been a bounty hunter. And she's also, you know, she's a lot of fun. She has a big comic streak. She's kind of a hoe sometimes. Like, she is all about having a good time. So she's a very different character for Tatiana Maslany to play. Maisley, I don't know how you say her name. I'm sorry.
Fair enough.
Grogu's sorry too.
Ryan, do you have any thoughts on the half-hour legal comedy She-Hulk show?
I mean, it's fine. It's something different from the MCU. So, you know, they like doing these genre things. So, I think it'll be interesting. I'm sure they will do fine with it. I hope Matt Murdock shows up.
I mean, yeah, I hope that too, though the Daredevil we've had most recently, I think would be very out of place on a comedy series, but maybe they can make that work somehow.
I mean, he'd be out of place in Spider-Man 3 probably too. It's so different than any other MCU property that it would be hard to fit it in somewhere, but the fans want it really badly. So I'm sure the studio wants to give it to him in some way. And so they're going to have to find a way to make it work.
That's fair. I do want to know now how Abomination is going to play a role in a show with that type of
tone. A half hour legal comedy.
Right? I mean, because at least, like, you know, Hulk, Banner is like that. He's in that middle ground now, right? Where he's the smart Hulk. But Abomination, I guess maybe he's smart Abomination. Is that a thing that happens? I don't think so.
He did a lot of studying in the raft while he was there. Is that where he's at? Something like that. I can't remember.
Great internet access at the raft.
Good Wi-Fi. Yeah. Google Fiber.
All right. Well, so again, the other piece of news came out today and is kind of like, it was small news that seems really big to me. MGM is looking to sell its entire film library and studio, which I would think would be massive news in the entertainment world. MGM owns a lot of stuff. James Bond, RoboCop, Candyman, the Rocky franchise, some of the Lord of the Rings stuff, not all of it, but some of it. Like, it's a lot of stuff. So is this big news or am I crazy?
I mean, it's kind of big news. I don't know. I guess I didn't know the extent of the stuff that they had. I get the feeling that maybe a streaming service taking it will be really good for whatever streaming service ends up, you know, getting all that content. But it just means that for me, that Army of Darkness is going to change ownership yet again and further complicate the distribution and everything else for the movie. But yeah, there's some good franchises there. So whoever gets it, hopefully they up their library a little bit.
Is there a company either of you would prefer purchases MGM?
I want Disney to stay the fuck away from it.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't prefer them either. I just want it to be somebody that I already subscribe to so that I don't have to buy another subscription. Put it on Netflix, buy them out. There we go.
Like, don't get me wrong, Disney is doing a lot of good things with the properties they own, but it's just getting to be a lot. And if Disney has bought, you know, Marvel and Star Wars and Fox, and they already had some control of MGM at some point and a lot of their properties, I just don't think that the whole Hollywood scene will stay, you know, disconnected. It's going to be a giant monopoly. So if somebody's going to do it, I'd rather a smaller company like Paramount do it, because they're still not as giant as some other ones.
Well, I mean, Paramount is backed by Viacom, so
yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's huge or it's not huge, but you know, Viacom doesn't have their own theme parks.
That's true. That is true. Though there is a Star Trek theme park in the country of Jordan, which
yes,
Viacom would own the rights to. So there you go. Yeah, I would like it to be Warner Brothers, frankly, so it would be part of HBO Max. I think tonally, that's where most of this content would fit really well. You know, if you look at just kind of this slate, like there's a comingsoon.net article's got a lot of really good information on this. And they mentioned how there's over 4,000 titles, and they include things like James Bond, Rocky, Pink Panther, Candyman, RoboCop, Stargate, Creed, Tomb Raider, like a lot of this stuff.
Darkness.
Army of Darkness. I think a lot of that would fit really well on HBO Max, which already has, you know, a leaning towards more adult level content.
Yeah, I could see it fitting in there for sure. But I wouldn't, like, it wouldn't stand out in a bad way on something like Netflix either, who's pretty small studio at this point. They're doing a lot of content, but it's not, you know, theater level content. And if they bought MGM, then they might get access to more resources than what they had before, besides the streaming library. So
very true. It's a good point. I think that would be a good decision for Netflix at this stage.
Did it say how much they're trying to shop it around for?
I didn't see any figures like that. The market value is estimated at $5.5 billion.
Pricey.
So, you know, it's not a small purchase.
It's a lot of zeros.
It's a lot of zeros. I would like some of those zeros.
Yeah, they could throw one our way. Just one.
All right. Anything else on the MGM deal?
No, sir.
Or the prospect of one. Okay. Cool. Well, then we're going to go ahead and take our first short break. And when we come back, we are celebrating Merry Cagemas with 1997's Face Off, starring Nicolas Cage and John Travolta. We will be right back. And we're back. All right, let's do this. Merry Cagemas to you all. This is our third and final week celebrating Merry Cagemas. We talked three different Nicolas Cage films, including this week. Last week was Ghost Rider, and the week before that was another movie that I can't remember.
Con Air.
Thank you. I wanted to say The Rock, which we talked about a couple of months ago, and I knew that was not right.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, we did The Rock back when Sean Connery passed away. So there you go. That's what we're doing. We're talking Face Off. 1997 films got a 7.2 on IMDb. Financially, did pretty well. $80 million budget, brought in $241 million worldwide, nearly a 50-50 split internationally and domestically. I had never seen Face Off.
Are you kidding me?
I had never had an opportunity to see it.
It came out. My mind is so blown right now. I thought you had seen it. So neither of you guys had seen it.
Correct.
Oh my gosh. Okay, this is going to be glorious.
Yeah. This is the first Nick Cage movie I haven't seen in a really long time, because I've watched not everything, but I've watched a lot of his stuff. It's pretty tough to watch everything.
And this is John Travolta too. Right. So I mean, that's a pretty big. Yeah.
In the 90s, you know, when John Travolta was like really at his peak. Before Battlefield Earth. That's right.
That's what killed it.
It didn't help. It definitely didn't help any. So this movie was really interesting for me because I had a lot of ideas of what it was, right? I'd seen the preview 1,000 times.
You'd seen the GIFs.
Right. You know, so I had ideas. I knew the general premise. They switch faces, right? But there were really some surprises in here in directions that they went on a lot of things. It's directed by John Woo. So you expect to see some doves. So they come pretty late in the movie, though.
Mexican standoffs. You get to see that too. Lots of religious symbolism, just like Zack Snyder. You know?
Yeah, they're both very different sides of that coin, aren't they?
I mean, are they really? Because I feel like they both have these superficial movies that they feel like are much deeper. And so they throw religious symbolism in to make themselves feel like it's a deeper movie and have people talk about it.
I don't disagree with that. But stylistically,
yeah,
they're very different.
But they're both very visual directors also. So, I mean, I don't know. I don't think they're that different. But one is a lot more CG and one's a lot more practical. But
So this is your spoiler warning for 1997's Face Off. There's one thing I just want to get out of the way right now because I thought it was hilarious. And I even had to roll it back to make sure that I saw what I thought I saw. In the beginning of the movie, when the plane crashes in the hangar and there's the fight in the hangar, there's an extra who gets knocked around a bit. And he is not only does the movement look like he's on a wire, you can see the wire in both shots. And it's so early on in the movie for such a mistake to hold. It was really funny. I just had to throw it out there.
Glad you got that out there.
So Ray, I know you're not like really enjoying Merry Cagemas, but in the spirit of the season, I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak your mind about Face Off.
You don't want me to do that.
I do. I definitely do.
That's why we have you on the show.
It's so awful. I hated it. Everything. This has literally ripped out my soul.
Okay.
Do you think your soul will return at some point?
She says she's shaking her head no. I mean, maybe Wonder Woman 84 this coming week will rejuvenate something. I don't know.
Wonder if Nick Cage shows up in it. That'd be great. What's another god he could be? Just show up at the end and it turns out he's actually some random god.
He's the Green Lantern.
There you go. Yeah, I'd be fine with that.
At this point, I think I would take anybody as a Green Lantern. I don't know that I have a preference. So, okay, I want to get a couple of things lined up here. There's some stuff this movie does well, honestly, and there's some stuff this movie really doesn't do well. One thing that it does really, really well that is far creepier than I ever thought it was going to be and much more intense than I ever thought it was going to be is the actual face off process. And the scene where Caster Troy doesn't have a face.
That gross you out?
It's so gross, and it's so well done.
You can hear in Nick Cage is voice acting with that, with like trying to talk like he doesn't have lips. I mean, that worked.
And he's smoking a cigarette the whole time without lips, and it's just, it's really gross. I thought the laser scene looked really good, and the way they, like, you know, they lift off the prosthetic. Considering this is a 1997 movie,
John Woo loves practical effects, and there are so many really great practical effects in this movie. So, but yes, that was a great, the whole time I was watching that scene, I kept telling Marcy, my girlfriend that was watching with me, that I wanted one of the prosthetic faces floating in as one of my props. If you don't know, I kind of collect some movie props. I wanted one of those faces floating in the vial for my prop room.
Oh man, that would be great. That would be a good prop.
So gross.
Yeah, you have that prop on like a shelf, and then hanging from the ceiling is Sylvester Stallone in the goo from Demolition Man.
There you go. Yeah, I'll take those, I'm sure. Just studios, call me up. I'll take them.
But yeah, I just thought that scene was really well done, and I guess I didn't anticipate it happening like that. So the idea that, you know, Caster's in a coma, and Sean's going to go undercover, Travolta's character is going to go undercover as Caster, that all worked for me really well. I didn't realize that, for some reason in my head, the swap was a conscious decision for both of them. Like, they were in on it together. It was like a decision made at the same time.
It was non-consensual for one of them, yeah.
And, well, I mean, the whole thing's pretty non-consensual too, since Caster takes Sean's face.
Right.
Right. And so that scene in the prison where Caster shows up as Sean, right, and Sean is there as a prisoner as Caster, is a fantastic scene.
It is.
I love that scene, and those two actors. Personally, I think John Travolta did a better job pretending to be Nicolas Cage.
Really?
I think he was awesome. This role for Travolta was so good. It was so good. I felt it. Like Nicolas Cage playing, like, guys, it's so hard to explain who sometimes in this movie. When Nicolas Cage has to pretend to be John Travolta pretending to be Caster, it was fine. It was fine. Nicolas Cage is fine as that. But John Travolta pretending to be Nicolas Cage pretending to be Sean was really one of my favorite things that I've seen happen to a major actor. It was awesome.
Wow. That was a mouthful.
Yes. Did you follow that, everybody?
Honestly, like, I thought they both had some tremendous moments in this movie. Yeah, you know, a lot of people, and I've mentioned this in our other reviews, like to poke fun at Nick Cage for, you know, whether they think you either think he's a good actor or you think he's a bad actor, and there's like nothing in the middle. But you know, this movie for me really showed that he is a good actor and he deserves to be up in the higher ranks. I mean, the scene when he's when his wife is running the blood tests and he shows up at the hospital, and he's like confessing everything and talking to, like, that was a really like, I believed that. He started crying and getting emotional talking to her about the date, the sesame seed and the chipped tooth. You know, that was a really good scene for Cage. They both had moments in this where I was just, blown away. I had this movie on VHS back when I was younger. And I watched the crap out of it. And watching it as an adult, there were things that definitely stood out to me as really great or really terrible, that I didn't necessarily notice when I was a kid. But yeah, that scene especially stood out to me for Nick Cage.
Ray, was there anything that you could take away from the film that you want to talk about, good or bad? Okay. So she's got some baby stuff going on. So we are going to just continue our conversation then, Ryan, until Ray is able to jump in. So Ray, you interrupt whenever you can. All right, cool. Thumbs up. All right. So some other things I liked in this movie. So the prison, as horrible as it was, I thought was incredibly well done and like sold how horrible it was. Right. Some of it may not be the most practical thing in the world, like the idea of the magnetic boots and everything logistically probably has some issues, you know, like how do the guys shower or anything like that. But the way the prison was designed, the idea that, you know, the guards kind of just let stuff happen, you know, and then they can kind of lock things down, I thought was a really interesting way to handle things. Having it be on an oil derrick was also really shocking because, you know, it didn't occur to me at all that that was the case, right? I assumed it was like in a desert somewhere or just, what you would normally see out on the outside of a prison in a movie, right? Big walls with, you know, things like that. And then, you know, he gets out and it's like, it's actually on an oil derrick in the middle of nowhere. And that was a really cool kind of twist for me. And it reminded me of, and of course now I've lost the name of it, but there was a series of movies that had to do with like being in these like weird prisons, and one of them takes place in space and the guy's trying to escape the prison and he gets to what he thinks is like an access point and he opens it up and it's just a window to outer space. And it was a really cool twist. This had that same effect, even though the movie's, you know, 13 years old, it still surprised me.
Yeah, funny thing about those boots, they were the same boots that Goombas wore in the Super Mario Brothers movie.
See, I thought they looked familiar, but I thought maybe I just saw it in promotional material.
Nope, that's what it was. That was a really cool. There was a lot. John Woo, you know, there's things he does not do well, just like Zack Snyder and just like a lot of our other favorite directors. But setting up cool action scenes and filming cool action scenes in a time where not a lot of people were really doing cool and inventive action scenes, he nailed it. And The Prison was a good example of that. You know, that was a cool set piece overall, and obviously I knew the twist because I've seen the movie before. I mean, the scene you were talking about when John Travolta comes in and talks to Nick Cage's character, and you know, the desperation, like even you as a viewer, I remember even when I was watching this as a kid, I was like, holy crap, man, can you imagine if this happened to you? Literally everybody that knew anything about this is gone. You're stuck in prison with somebody else's face with a bunch of people who hate you. You know, there was a lot of really well-used dramatic tension in this movie. And some of it was much grosser in terms of like sexual assault and things like that than other. But yeah, I think that that scene and the ensuing stuff in the jail was a really good use of that kind of weird tension that you can only get in a situation like this.
Well, and that scene is kind of mirrored later on in the film during the big shootout that happens at the condo or the loft or whatever, where they're standing on opposite sides of a mirror.
Yeah.
Right. So they're both looking at the person they hate because they're wearing that person's face.
But that is their person. Yeah. That is them. And they're both pointed guns at each other's heads, but it's actually their own head in the mirror. Yeah. That's a cool. And again, that's something that John Woo does really well, I think.
It's a really cool scene. And it's a nice juxtaposed to the first one back at the prison, I think, because now they're on equal footing. Right. Because obviously in that first scene, that's not the case, right? Nicolas Cage's character is in a lot of trouble and is freaking out, rightfully so.
Yeah.
But at that scene, in the second scene, they're on equal footing at that point. They both got their guns drawn. They're both in the middle of this fight, what have you. Things, they're like, those two characters are good throughout most of the movie. I have very, very few complaints about those two characters. It's the rest of the characters that make a lot of really weird decisions and say really weird stuff sometimes. And it starts with Nicolas Cage's escape. I'm just gonna go with the actor names to avoid confusion.
That's the best way to do it.
With Nicolas Cage's escape from the oil rig prison, when he jumps into the water, the guys in the helicopter who are supposed to stop this from happening just assume he's dead. There's no body. Right. This dude just jumped off of this oil rig and clearly wants to escape. And they just are like, meh, I guess he died. And John Travolta's character is like, well, do you have a body? Right. That's the right question to ask, because like, why are you assuming this dude's dead? Especially when they think it's actually the real Caster Troy, who's this incredibly dangerous terrorist.
Yeah.
Right. This isn't just the dude who like jacked a car or something.
So when I say that John Woo is really good at setting up cool action set pieces and just like kind of dramatic scenes, he isn't good at like the explaining of how they get to those scenes. The people just kind of show up, and this happens several times in the movie. Like the scene I was talking about earlier in the hospital, really, really wonderful scene. But like Nick Cage's character just shows up in the hospital out of nowhere. He's standing like next to the wall and says he's been waiting there for her, but somehow she's been running his blood tests and stuff like this without noticing that he's there. And I mean, I don't know. There were several scenes like that where the person just conveniently happened to be there, and you don't really know. You know, it's not a place that they should be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that happens several times in this movie. But that's a very good example of it, is the oil rig escape.
Yeah, well, to kind of follow that, there's also like when Nicolas Cage breaks into his own house later in the film, right, to convince his wife. Like, there's guards on the house. You'd think there'd be surveillance cameras or something like that, and he doesn't seem to have a problem getting in. We don't get to really see how he does it.
We just see like him walking outside, and then he's inside the house.
And then not only is he inside, he's upstairs
in the bedroom. Yeah,
you know. And like, look, don't get me wrong. I know like the wife, Jamie, doesn't. Or not Jamie. What was the wife's name?
I don't remember.
Eve. Yeah. Jamie's the daughter. Eve doesn't scream, but like, I feel like they made enough noise for the cop who's down the stairs to hear her interacting with somebody. And maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's a stretch, but that scene is intense, by the way.
Yeah, it is. His wife, that actress, is very good and really sold that scene. I don't think you know, it's just Nick Cage and John Travolta that were really great in this movie. There were some other people that were, you know, side characters, but they definitely made, you know, they made the movie much more, I don't know, tense with their acting, because they're good actors. So
yeah, Joan Allen does a really good job. She doesn't get a lot to work with, but she does a really good job with what she has. I would like to believe that I would be more suspicious if my spouse was replaced with a completely different person. Like, I think for me, part of the problem is John Travolta's character does know Caster Troy, because he's basically spent the last 6 years of his life hunting this man down for the murder of his son. But it doesn't necessarily follow the other way, that Caster would know Sean as well. And they know each other equally as well when they switch these spots and sink into each other's lives, like, almost seamlessly. And
well, I mean, he doesn't know him that well. He drives by the house the first time. The only reason he stops is because he sees his wife coming out. But so, I mean, there's some explanation that he doesn't know everything about.
True. But he knows it well enough to convince both his wife and daughter, she's a teenager, she's basically an adult, to convince both of them that he is this person, when you'd think there'd be some weird alarms.
There are bigger stretches in the movie, so that wasn't really a problem for me. I mean, if somebody showed up to my house looking exactly like my girlfriend and just acting a little different, I mean, people have off days, you know, there are all kinds of things. He was middle-aged. He could be like a midlife crisis, you know, any number of things to explain that. There's much more hard to believe things in this movie than that. So I'm fine with that. It never bothered me. I'm sorry that it bothered you, but.
It didn't bother me enough to ruin anything. It was just there in my mind of like, I would hope that I would have figured it out sooner.
You'd hope,
you know, because like Joan Allen's character, Eve, is a doctor too, so it's not like, you know, she's, you know, an average intelligence person, right? She's a legit doctor who, you know, is like on call in emergency rooms and is doing these blood tests and everything like that. So you'd think there'd be a little bit more. And then kind of following that a little bit, Caster kills everybody involved with the Face Off project.
Yeah,
right. But he still wants his face back later in the movie. So my question would be, like, who does he think's gonna do that?
I mean, maybe he doesn't seem like the guy to really think ahead on stuff like that. It seemed like his brother was more the planner. You know what I mean?
Gotcha.
And so he just is kind of a wild dog chasing a car and doesn't know what he's gonna do with it when he catches it.
I mean, maybe, but earlier on in the movie, they show that not really to be the case, because he understands the idea of like, well, you don't pay for the jet yet, right? Because we don't want that to be traced to us. And he's tying his brother's shoe, right? Like he seems a little bit more on the ball. He's a total like short fuse nutcase, but he seems to be pretty.
Yeah. He's not stupid by any means,
you know? So, okay. Yeah. So what for you then was the less believable stuff in the movie? Or the stretch.
The whole like actual face off process. Like well, you know, John Travolta's case is like a face is much thicker than Nicolas Cage's, but they somehow resolved that with just like this plastic face insert that goes underneath the face to reshape it. You know, there's a lot related to that whole thing that was weird. And also, like, he had to tell his wife the blood types before she did the blood test. So why would if it was you're just trying to like get her to believe that it was you. Why wouldn't you just tell her the, you know, he could have just said, well, I may be blood type or whatever. And she would have believed it because she didn't know his blood type ahead of time. He had to say, I'm O blood type. He's AB. So test his blood. And if it's AB, then it's him. And you know, I'm telling the truth. You know what I mean? That, I don't know.
Yeah. I thought that was more for the audience benefit of explaining the different blood types rather than
potentially, yeah,
you know, but
I mean, basically I guess, all the gunplay yeah, being gunplay. Effective at all is it's a John Woo thing and I enjoy it, but it doesn't, you know, it's not very believable that anybody could shoot accurately doing any of the things that they were doing in this movie. So that's a big suspension of disbelief type thing.
Okay. So with the actual face off process, that's like the whole conceit of the movie. So I just kind of like put that aside. I'm like, right. We're assuming that works.
The right? Actors really sell it. They make it work. Both of them do a good job. You know. So it doesn't really pull you out of the movie, except in the beginning when you're like, how did they just slim up his face so much?
There's a lot of those issues, right? Because you also have like when Castor becomes Sean, he doesn't have the scar on his chest. And if he's sleeping with Sean's wife, you'd think she would notice that, because it's like right there. You also
think she would notice a different penis.
I mean, yeah, there's that too. And there's different, like, you know, different body hairs, and just there's no way, like, their shoe size is identical and everything too. Like, you have to kind of just throw that aside for the rest of the movie. But for the gun stuff, I'm totally with you, because both of them are the best shots in the world until they're shooting at each other.
Then they can't hit anything. But how cool were Caster Troy's guns, though?
The two pistols are cool.
Those gold 1911s, those are freaking cool looking. I've always loved those things. And his suit, that one he gets like right in the beginning of the movie with like the red shirt, oozes like John Woo, like coolness. This is something that really blew my mind watching it as an adult, is that this was way before like John Wick. You look now, like John Wick is like the definitive action movies right now. You know, other movies that are coming out are doing very similar things to John Wick, you know, like Birds of Prey and some of those. But John Wick right now is what this movie was back then. I mean, this was a guy that came out with a style of action movie mm-hmm. that people hadn't seen anything like before. And it set up, you can see now looking back on this, all the things that this movie set up for John Wick and a mm-hmm. lot of similar action movies. The gunplay, it's a lot less realistic than John Wick, but you can definitely see like some of the influences there. And I really appreciate that watching this now, having seen some more modern action movies and seeing how far ahead of his time John Woo was with the way he was doing these things.
Well, I think even a closer comparison is, I think there's a lot to be said that was taken from this for Matrix. Matrix is more technology, right? Because it had all the 360 bullet time camera tricks that they used, but the gunplay is very similar.
Yeah. And Matrix was only a couple years after. So
yeah, 1999.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I definitely agree. And all of them are Keanu Reeves, you know, John Wick and Matrix. So
that's true. Yeah.
He just really liked this movie. Apparently he's like, I want to get into every movie that uses this kind of action scene. But no, yeah. When I was watching this movie, Matrix was in my head too. There was a lot of scenes where I was like, okay, yeah, this is definitely an influence. Mm-hmm. So it is cool to see how this movie and, you know, some of John Woo's other movies kind of set up the action movies for the future.
Yeah, I agree.
It's always cool to see an artist ahead of their time that like is, and you can follow the influence. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The scene that kind of was a little too much for me for the gunplay stuff was the church scene, because it's such a small church and there's like, you know, like five people, they've all got their guns drawn and everything. They're right there. And neither of the two main guys get shot.
Yeah. It's, I mean, he has a Mexican standoff like that in every movie. And so it's kind of a signature thing and he has to come up with a way to resolve it. And this one was really great because every time you think that this there's enough people involved in this, there's like another, it's like the ending of Return of the King, but like with a standoff, like every time you think there's not anybody, any way anybody else could show up, somebody else shows up with two guns pointed at two people. And so it's this giant web of guns.
And, well, yeah, and John Travolta's character, his version of Caster Troy or whatever, he kind of even almost gets a little meta about it because he even acknowledges how ridiculous it's getting, you know, and like that part was all fine. It was just that like neither of them even get clipped.
But tell me how great the like lead up into that was with the doves and with Nick Cage praying and like, you know,
so over the top.
So ending the picture of the kid, it's like it's so great.
At first I thought they were going to go a different route because you hadn't seen any doves in the movie yet. Right. But it cuts to the beach seagulls. And you see the seagulls. I'm like, okay, well, you know, they're not doves, but they're white birds.
They're white. Yeah.
You know, so that's fine. You know, John decided to kind of just go a different route.
Mix it up a little bit.
And then the church has like 800 doves in it.
Well, if you notice, the church has no doors. It's literally just curtains hanging over every opening. So doves can easily get in. You know, that's how they made it believable.
Where are the seagulls?
That's a good point. It was all doves in the church. They're very classist, those doves. They don't want any dirty seagulls joining them in the church.
I did love the photo, right? Having the photo delivered to John Travolta was a baller move.
Oh, yeah.
But it that scene definitely is like peak John Woo.
Oh yeah, it's so good. Like the slow motion with the swinging of that like smoking thing for the funeral. You know, the religious like music in the background. It's peak John Woo, and I loved it.
In fact, the movie did. I did not like the boat scene. I thought it was too much, too long. It was too Michael Bay in a movie that was doing its own thing.
But in defense of the boat scene, the stunts in that scene were all practical. There were legit stunt people hanging off the sides of these boats. You could tell in the scene with the boat like flying through the air onto the beach. Those were real stunt people jumping. Like this is all practically done. This movie should have gotten awards for the stunt work if it didn't, because I mean, all the stunt work in this movie was practically done and it looks incredible and believable.
Unfortunately, no, it was nominated for best effects, sound editing. That was one category at the time. It did not win. It won other awards. It won Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy and Horror Films awards for best director, best writer. It was nominated for a slew of awards for that. Stunt awards, unfortunately, haven't been given the respect that they really deserve, because at the end of the day, even now with CGI the way it is, most of our favorite movies wouldn't look anything like they do without the stunt crews. And I mean, it's about time that those actors get recognition. They really deserve it.
Well, like 1977, when this movie came out, they should have gotten recognition for it. I mean, when Nick Cage is hanging off the side of the boat and the boat's going like 40 miles an hour, and you're seeing a real person hanging off, holding a chain off the side of the boat, like slamming into the boat, slamming into the water. That's some serious shit. I didn't appreciate that growing up and watching this movie. But as an adult, I'm going, holy crap, man. They really went for it, whoever the stunt team was.
Well, for the MTV Movie and TV Awards, it did win both Best On-Screen Duo for John and Nick, but it also won Best Action Sequence for the boat chase.
It was a good action sequence on its own. I think that this movie is so jam-packed with action sequences that I could easily see how somebody would be like, yeah, it was too much. It doesn't, you know, I'm sorry that you didn't enjoy it as much as you potentially could have if you know, it had been shorter or a little better edited. But
yeah, I just felt like it was a little much. Like the movie had done a really good job up until that point with all the action sequences, and it just was a little much is all. Gotcha. The final confrontation with them once they crash and everything was good. You know, they're using the harpoon gun and everything, and like that was a good moment. It was just a little much leading up to it. It just felt too Michael Bay.
Did you like the crucifixion pose that he dies in, that John Travolta's character dies in?
I didn't notice.
Yeah, when he gets harpooned, his hands are out like this, and his feet are together, just like a crucifixion. It's like it was so on the nose.
That's
hilarious. Like, why are we making him Jesus? Like, of all things, that we're gonna make Caster Troy Jesus? Like, come on.
I didn't notice.
I'm all for religious symbolism, but that making Superman Jesus, sure, right? Like, that makes sense. But Caster Troy? He's a terrorist. Why are we giving him a Jesus pose to die in?
That's really funny. I didn't notice. That's a good catch, though. It's a good eye.
I didn't notice. I didn't know it when I was younger, but yeah, watching it now and seeing like the church scene where everything is like focused on Jesus on the cross and everything else. Yeah, it stood out like big time.
So I want your opinion on this. So before John Woo was attached as the director, two different actors were like intended for the roles, and it was Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I know who it is.
Stallone.
Sylvester Stallone. I know who it was. Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, Travolta and Cage did a phenomenal job in this, but I'm a little sad we never got the Schwarzenegger Stallone face off movie.
I'm a little sad about that, but like, really, do you think that would have been a good movie or a better movie than this?
Not at all. No. But I think I would watch it once a year because of what
the only reason been. That this movie was good, in my opinion, and obviously Rachel didn't think it was good, so not everybody's going to share this opinion, but the only reason the movie worked on any level was because of John Travolta, Nick Cage, and John Woo. Those are the only reasons it worked on any level. If you take any of those pieces out, I don't think it works, unfortunately.
Fair enough. I mean, obviously, a Schwarzenegger Stallone film would have been completely different.
Yeah, and whoever directed. I mean, it would have been different. Yeah. I would think that it would have been more like Twins, like action comedy rather than...
I saw it as like more of like having like Demolition Man go up against like...
Terminator.
No, but maybe like... oh my God, his Predator character. I can't believe
it. Dutch?
Dutch, thank you. Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to ask this question to you legitimately. Do you think that either of those two actors in 1997 are good enough actors?
No, it would have been ridiculous. It would have been unintentionally hilarious.
But I don't think that, it would have been like one of those movies we look back on now and go, wow, this is so terrible that I love it.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I think it would have been. Absolutely.
I appreciate this movie for not being that. I mean, I watched this movie for this, and I enjoyed it just as much as I did, if not more than I did when I was a younger man watching it on my little like VCR TV in my bedroom with a 13-inch screen.
That's cute.
It's one of Nick Cage's best acting roles, in my opinion. He really got to like go crazy. At, like when he was Caster Troy in the beginning, he was crazy, man. He really went far, with the whole church, the whole priest scene with the dancing and stuff like that, and the grabbing of the girl's butt. Like that was so creepy and nasty. And
he's very good at being creepy. I think
he is, but then he was really good at being dramatic too. You know, he got to go on both extremes in this movie. And he's said, I've watched some interviews with him. I know it's hard to believe, but he said that he would love to revisit the Caster Troy character again, because he had so much fun and didn't get to be Caster Troy for very long in the movie. I don't know how they would do that. Like make it a prequel and have him like swap hands with somebody or something. And I don't know. Hands off.
There you go.
That wouldn't work for Caster Troy, but
I like it. No, I mean, yeah, you could do a prequel. Right, that leads up to why he's supposed to be assassinating Sean.
Yeah, and give some context to like him and Sean Archer's relationship before
the movie takes place. You can literally have the last scene, like the last shot in the film, be right as he pulls the trigger.
Yeah,
right. Yeah. And you don't actually get to see the son die. You just know that leads into face off. You get a whole movie of that mustache.
Oh God, that mustache was really. Really something special.
Oh man,
I would watch a whole movie of just that mustache and like the up close shots where you could like see the hairs moving when he was like breathing or taking a drink.
Oh god,
Those were some good shots. That was some John Woo there. I like that.
Yeah. What'd you think of the ear 3D printer as a person who professionally does 3D printing?
It's interesting now because 3D printing back then was not really a thing.
Right.
They were, you know, and the fact or the thought of 3D printing a body part was so far out there. People couldn't even figure out, like, if you said the words 3D printer to somebody, they'd have no idea what the fuck you were talking about. But, you know, nowadays they're actually talking about, they can do tissue printing, and they have 3D printed, you know, meat patties that you can eat and things like that. So it's crazy that this movie was so ahead of its time. It was kind of like Small Soldiers, where they had the resin 3D printing, which was something that nobody had any idea what that was, but they still showed that detail in a movie that was way, you know, way older than the technology practically. But that was cool. I thought that was neat.
I mean, back then, if you needed a new ear, you had to grow it on the back of a rat. You guys remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what you had to do. That would have been cool, just growing Nicolas Cage's face on the back of like a mouse.
Ooh, I'd want that prop. the mouse with the Nick Cage face on it? Yeah.
Oh, man. All right.
So you finally got, watching this movie, got context for all the memes.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of memes from this movie.
There are a lot.
Do you think you will be using those more? Because let's face it, whenever Nick Cage comes up in a Facebook post or whatever, the default gif for Derek is the Con Air like hair breeze blowing.
It's my favorite. That
might change.
I don't know, based
on context.
That Con Air gif is my single favorite shot of Nicolas Cage as a human being. So
none of the Caster Troy stuff will ever top that.
Not on a regular basis. I mean, I might use those now because I understand them better. But at the end of the day, if I just want a gorgeous Nicolas Cage, it's the Con Air gif. That's just the way it goes.
Fair enough. I can definitely understand that. The hair is glorious.
All right, so we got to switch over to The Mandalorian here because we have gone long on this segment of the podcast. So, Ryan, any final remarks on Face Off?
I mean, if you haven't seen it and you like Nick Cage or John Travolta or you like action movies in general, I think this is definitely a worthy watch. It doesn't feel as dated as it probably should, in my opinion. But yeah, check it out if you haven't seen it. And if you have seen it, then you already know what we're talking about and how great it is. So yeah, talk to us about it on Twitter because I'll chat Nick Cage all day.
Ray, I'm going to give you an opportunity here. Do you want to say anything about Face Off before we switch subjects?
Oh my God, never again.
Okay. That was
so Derek, you're going to be watching it by yourself.
We own it now because Con Air and Face Off were so cheap to purchase on DVD.
Do you feel like you're going to watch it again someday?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so you liked it. Did it crack into your top five 90s action movies?
I don't know about that. I'd have to sit down and make a list. But I really enjoyed it, and I thought they both did such a great job. And there's parts of this movie that I think are really cool. The concept is still really original and really interesting. And the fact that nobody's really tried to rip it off is interesting and maybe implies that it's just a very complicated idea to try and put a movie around. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
All right, well, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we are talking The Mandalorian Season 2 finale. So this is your spoiler warning for the finale of The Mandalorian and anything associated with that. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. We're talking The Mandalorian Season 2 finale and everything that happened with that. All right, so couple bits of news I just want to get out of the way and make sure it's clear for everybody. The post-credit scene that announced the Book of Boba Fett is officially its own dedicated Disney Plus series. It is not Mandalorian Season 3. Mandalorian Season 3 is happening. Pedro Pascal is attached to it, and it will begin filming after the Book of Boba Fett is done filming. So that is official news from Disney, from Jon Favreau. That's what's happening. The plan is for The Mandalorian, essentially, to build a small cinematic universe of Star Wars content with Boba Fett, the Rangers of the New Republic, and Ahsoka all existing within that time period of The Mandalorian. So those characters can cross over with each other. You can probably expect that to some extent. And the Book of Boba Fett is its own thing, not season three of The Mandalorian. Okay. Wanted to get that out of the way because there was a lot of confusion about that from a lot of people. So here we go. Mandalorian season finale. Who wants to start?
You.
Okay. So there's some good stuff in this episode. There's some bad stuff in this episode. I don't think it's an incredible episode. I think they tried some stuff that worked, and I think they tried some stuff that didn't. I liked Gideon in this episode, right? Because we didn't get a lot of him before this. We knew obviously that he's powerful, that he's ruthless, right? Things like that. But this, we really got like monologues from him, and we got some back and forth, and we got to see his level of intelligence and
his combat abilities.
The scene in the brig was a really, really good scene. And I was really floored when it looked like he was going to let Mando walk away with Grogu. I was like, really? That just seems crazy to me. And I'm glad they didn't actually go that route, because we got to see him fight. And we got to see, you know, got to see Mando use the Beskar staff, which I'm sure we all knew was coming at this point. Yeah. So that was really cool. I really liked that part of the episode. I thought that the Dark Troopers were pretty wasted, with really the only exception being the one scene where Mando has to fight the one Dark Trooper. But otherwise, I thought they were wasted.
Okay.
Do you disagree?
I mean, they were... Yeah, I would have liked to have seen more of them, but I think that for this season, that probably would have been cramming too much into it. So I'm fine with them being used as a vehicle to show power levels of other characters, which is essentially what they came out to be, because you see Mando fighting one.
Yeah.
And basically just getting destroyed by it, other than a lucky shot with the spear. the scene with the Dark Trooper just pounding and pounding and pounding his helmet into the ship was really cool. The Beskar did not give, but the ship's hull started to give. That was neat. I did think it's a little silly that apparently all they can do is punch people really hard. Yeah, it seems like a huge waste of technology. Yeah. But I'm sure they can do other things. It's just, that's what they came up with this season. But, you know, to see Mando, who's a capable fighter, and somebody we've seen fight a lot of times and defeat a lot of people, barely get by one. And then to see the Jedi show up and just start wasting them, you know, killing like a whole platoon of these things without any trouble, is just to use to show a power difference, right? And it's made to have Mando go, well, crap, this guy is insanely powerful. I have no way of beating this guy. Not that he wants to, but in right. his head, I'm sure tactically he's thinking that this is not going to be something that goes well.
That's fair. Yeah.
The Dark Troopers, the thing I didn't like about them was that they're basically, as far as I could tell, all CGI. There's a more CGI use in this than there has been in other episodes. There's a lot of the Dark Trooper CGI, and then there's some Grogu CGI too when he's moving around on the ground, and he doesn't move like puppet Grogu does. That's really hard to emulate in CGI, yeah. And so it makes it stand out really poorly when they end up having to use CGI Grogu. But
yeah, I mean, they had those same issues with Yoda, you know, and that's why Yoda looked really good in The Last Jedi. Right. But he looked, I don't know, just never quite right in the prequels when he was the CGI Yoda. It just didn't quite look right. Because it's difficult. It's kind of like how in the Dark Crystal Netflix show, like it's almost all practical effects, but when they use CGI, it was a little more glaring because it has to balance off of
right
puppetry, and those things just don't mesh well.
So often. We had a question in chat asking if the Darksaber has similar abilities to the lightsabers, and if there's only one Darksaber.
I have a lot of questions about the Darksaber myself, because the way it's framed at the end of the episode, where Bo has to win it in battle, but in I think it was Rebels. She's just handed it at some point. I don't understand. How can the sword know how it was won?
Okay. So to answer the actual question, instead of going off on a tangent, the Darksaber is implied. I haven't watched the cartoons that this came from. As I understand it, the Darksaber is extremely similar to a lightsaber, other than maybe the shape, it having a flatter blade instead of the rounded blade of a lightsaber. But it obviously generates a similar amount of heat to a lightsaber. You can see it superheating the Beskar staff. Is there only one Darksaber? As far as we know, yes, there's only one Darksaber, and whoever wields it in general is the leader of the Mandalorians. Or the Mandalore themselves. So take that for what it's worth. I'm not one that has watched the cartoons, so I don't know much about the Darksaber. This is just based on conversations I've had with people that know more than I do about those particular shows. But
well, and the follow-up to that in chat was like, is it a sentient thing? And like, that's my question, right? Like, the sword knows how the wielder
It's not a sentient thing. It's an honor thing.
So Mandalore won't follow Bo because she didn't win the sword.
It's implied that for her to actually like become the leader of Mandalore with honor, the honor that carries, she has to win the Darksaber in combat. That's how the Mandalore is crowned. If he hands the Darksaber to her, she hasn't won it in combat and she won't have that honor, even though there's like a small group of people that would know that.
So then,
it's for her own knowledge, and I can't answer the question about Rebels if that's what you're getting ready to ask.
No, it's not.
Totally different question.
That's not what I'm going to ask. I don't want to go down that route either. But it's more of like, so at this point, who rules Mandalore then? Because clearly Din doesn't want to.
Well, nobody really rules Mandalore because Mandalore is gone. But
right. Yes,
the leader of the Mandalorians at this point. I mean, I would assume that all the Mandalorians now would be, you know, if it was. I don't know how many Mandalorians still believe in the old tradition of that. It's implied that Bo and her little crew does, but the rest of the Mandalorians that we've seen, like, you know, the armor and that whole sect that was with Din, they were extremists. They might not believe in the Darksaber. He didn't even know about the Darksaber. So, you know, it's likely that it's not all Mandalorians are going to be like, well, you're our leader now. But you know, that's kind of what Bo seems to want to bring back, is that same, those same rule sets that she kind of grew up into.
Hmm. Yeah. That just didn't really, the end of the episode started to fall apart for me, because you also have like Gideon gets the gun and shoots point blank range and hits Bo like three times, but she's fine.
She has Beskar armor. So I don't know why that's so hard to believe.
That armor does not cover 100% of her body, and he knows
the important parts.
She is standing totally fine with everybody else in that pretty shot at the end of the episode, so she wasn't even clipped. And I just find it unlikely that Gideon of all people would shoot his shot without knowing that he could shoot her in the knee or something. And at least
shooting her in the knee wouldn't stop her.
Neither would shooting her in the chest, because she's wearing the armor that he knows maybe, she has.
Maybe he's making a bet that it's not Beskar. I don't know. This is all writing stuff. It's, you know, yeah, I thought that was weird too. It also like really never shows her getting up. So you're not sure if she's like dead or not until like the very last second when she's standing with the rest of the group. So that was a little weird.
That was.
So instead of nitpicking this, we should talk about like what we think the future is going to kind of lead into with this show. Do you think Grogu is going to stay with Luke? We haven't really mentioned it, but yes, Luke and his kill box scene was awesome. We'll get that out of the way. I'm sure you don't disagree with that, Derek. That was really cool, right?
Until you see his face. Yeah, until you see his face, it's wonderful. You know, when the X-Wing shows up, I'm like, oh my God, they're actually doing Luke. Because I really didn't think they were going to do Luke, because I didn't think they'd be able to keep it under wraps that they had gotten Sebastian Stan to do it or something. And it never really occurred to me that they would just CGI Mark Hamill. Think that the episode shows why I didn't think they were going to do that. But when the X-Wing shows up, it's clearly going to be him. And then you see the green saber and you're like, oh, okay, well, it's definitely Luke now. And that was really cool. Seeing R2 was cute. Seeing Grogu and R2 kind of have a thing was cute, because it implies that they might actually know each other, which is very possible. And so there's some cool fan theories that maybe R2 helped save Grogu during the Order 66. And that's very possible. They were both alive during that time. That's a very real possibility. And that would be a cool piece of lore, because R2 has been involved in a lot of serious stuff in the Star Wars universe. It kind of just gets glossed over because he doesn't speak anything we understand.
Right.
So I think Grogu has to stay with Luke for some amount of time, not forever, of course. And even if he stays for 10 years to become, you know, a Jedi, I mean, Luke only trained for like 5 with Yoda to become the Jedi Knight that he is in Return of the Jedi. So you would think Grogu spending 5 to 10 years with Luke would then go off and do his own thing.
But 5 to 10 years for his species is probably not enough for him to be like able to be out on his own.
That's unclear. Yeah, I'm not sure.
We did have a question in chat about is everyone's armor Beskar or just Din's? I don't think they've really like touched on that. I know that like in before the Mandalorian show, Boba Fett's armor was not Beskar. It was Durasteel, which is still resistant to lightsabers. But it seems like they've kind of retconned that for the show. And they haven't really outright said that that everybody has Beskar. But I would say that, yeah, somebody else in chat said that they're all different levels of like impurity in Beskar. And that's probably likely, or Durasteel, if they're still using that. Which they haven't really touched on that, as far as I know, in anything canon in a while. So
their armor's as strong as the plot needs it to be.
Yeah, exactly. So do you think the show is going to go on without Grogu and with Mando, with Din?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I don't think they will do that. There's no fucking way that this cash cow they have of Grogu is going to be going away.
I mean, Grogu can't just be there on episode 1 of season 3 after all of that.
Oh, he's going to be. Spoiler alert.
Come on.
But that, I mean, like, there's... That makes going to happen.
Then what's the whole point of him even leaving with Luke?
To have it give everybody a really cool thing to talk about for the next year. And to tune in to see what happens next year. But it's literally the Mandalorian and Baby Yoda show. So you can't, the show has nothing at this point. Let's face it. The reason that everybody was talking about this show in season 1 was not because of how cool Mando was. It was because of Baby Yoda. And it's always been about Baby Yoda, every bit of it. Grogu has been the main focus of the show, and he's going to continue to be. I don't see there being any way that they go more than 1 or 2 episodes without Grogu in the next season.
All right.
Maybe they'll do a time skip.
Then I was just going to say, then there should be a time jump involved. I don't want him to just show back up a week later. Okay. I want Grogu to have some time with Luke to have made the last 2 seasons worth it.
I also think that it would be a much more interesting story to tell if Grogu does have some training mm-hmm. and can do something other than just waddle around or float around in the bassinet.
And eat eggs.
Yeah. You know, I think him having some training and some level of control over his abilities. I do think it's adorable whenever he uses his abilities, he just falls asleep. So I think they should keep that. Like, Luke can't train him for more than like 10 minutes at a time because he just falls asleep. But I hope that he does get some training and some level of control over some of his abilities. And maybe we'll get some cool new force abilities from it, because he's a young child. He's just discovering this force, you know, world. So maybe he'll not have like filters like an adult or a teenager would have going into this world, having seen force powers be used, you know.
Well, and even Luke uses powers in the new trilogy that we didn't know before. So Luke could train his people on those abilities as well.
Well, that force crush ability that Luke uses on the Dark Trooper is not something that we've seen much of really at all.
Not from him.
Right.
Yeah.
We have seen it before, but from him it's a totally new thing. I don't even have we seen it on a light side person before?
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head.
I don't know. It's been a while since I've watched all the movies, but that was a really cool scene, and you know, it shows that Luke is clearly still, you know, training and discovering abilities. So
well, yeah, I mean, it's been 5 years since Return of the Jedi, so the idea that he's more powerful now and more in control of his abilities is the correct direction to go. And so I'm glad that they were able to show that. My concern with bringing Grogu back too soon is that, like, we have a pretty emotional scene, right? Din takes his helmet off, Grogu touches his face, right? There's this whole thing about how, like, nobody has touched as far as we know, no living anything has touched his face since he was a child. It's a big moment. He's very sad. It's very emotional. If he just shows back up, I think it just kind of pulls that punch a bit. And I want there to be, you know, some real consequences has a negative connotation, but some real effects of them going their separate ways for some time.
I mean, we definitely, just because of the sequel trilogy, know that Grogu does not stay with Luke, because we know that Kylo Ren goes and kills all Luke's students and, you know, tries to kill Luke and burns everything to the ground. So unless Kylo killed Grogu, which the internet would not stand for, we know he doesn't stay with Luke.
Not forever, but there's a good amount of time between when Grogu leaves with Luke and when Ben would be old enough to do that.
But the amount of time is not very big for his species. So
that's true.
You know, it might be, what is it, 20 years? I don't remember when the Force Awakens takes place.
It's 30 or 40 years after the old trilogy, which, you know, this
is 25 years difference between, you know.
So if Grogu trains for 10 years with Luke and then leaves, he would have still missed all of that stuff.
He'd still been a baby at that point, probably.
I mean, that's the thing. We don't really know
how it works.
Yeah.
We assume that, you know, if he's maybe at 50 years old, 10 years is not really going to make that much of a difference.
Is it because he's 50, or is it because he's been like basically locked away in hiding since Order 66?
Yeah, it's hard to say. We don't know the biology of or physiology of the species. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that I do think the sequels may have pigeonholed him a little bit on what they can do. You know, they can't have him keep going back to Luke and
And like in chat mentioned that Kylo didn't kill everybody. He took some of the students with him. And I don't see Grogu being a Knight of Ren.
I don't think Grogu was a Knight of Ren, but yes, you're right. I'm sorry. I said that he killed everybody.
Grogu is a Knight of Ren. I mean, does that mean he died in Rise of Skywalker then?
I don't know. I don't even want to think about that. I don't want to think about those movies.
So where do you want it to go? What do you want to see?
I'd like to see more of Din with the other group of Mandalorians, the Bo's group. I don't know if they have a name, but I loved seeing their group tactics together. The way they fight is totally different than Din. And I would love to see kind of some of Din's fighting abilities kind of translate over to them, but then also their group fighting tactics transferring over to him and kind of like a shared knowledge. And I think that they have to kind of stay at the very least in contact, because he's got the Darksaber and she wants it, and they're going to have to resolve that somehow. So
I do want to say, to your point about the way they fight, the jetpack usage in the fight choreography in this show with her group specifically is awesome, and some of the coolest use of jetpack I've ever seen in anything.
Yeah, that was great. That scene with the bridge was awesome. I love that it's so well thought out that you can see the difference in the fighting styles between, you know, them utilizing all these cool group tactics versus Din just being a brawler. Mm-hmm. I love that so much. The action nerd in me it eats up details like that. So yeah,
it's just cool. Like, we see characters that can fly all the time, whether they're superheroes or they're in a mech suit or whatever, but they don't tend to be particularly agile during the flight process.
But it's their armor is, like you mentioned earlier, it's very small compared to their bodies. So they definitely have more movement ability than even like Din, because his is much more bulky and covers a lot more of his body than somebody like Bo's. So,
but it just kind of, for me, it feels like the next evolution of what Favreau learned in Iron Man, you know, and he's just gotten better.
Yeah. I squealed a couple times with some of the like when Bobo and the, I don't remember the other woman's name. The Mandalorian, not Bo, the other one in there.
Oh, the character Sasha plays.
Yeah, yes, exactly. That fight scene between them and the usage of the jetpacks and even that small space was really, really cool. I enjoyed that thoroughly. Plus, seeing Boba, this revered character that didn't do shit in the original trilogy, getting his ass kicked they both kicked each other's asses, so it wasn't like a straight up victory or anything, but seeing him get tossed around like that was pretty cool. I really liked that scene.
Yeah, that's another really good example of it. So it's cool to see how far Favreau's come, because, I mean, 2008's Iron Man is still one of my favorite movies, and it's still probably my favorite MCU film. And he's just gotten better at that kind of thing. And considering how good he was, it's amazing to think that he just continues to improve.
Absolutely.
So there is the Boba Fett thing if you're ready to talk about that.
Sure, we can talk about Boba.
Okay. So there's a post-credit scene, which was definitely a risky thing for Disney to do, because I don't think most people were anticipating watching through the credits, since none of the other episodes have had post-credit scenes. But there is a post-credit scene. Boba and Fennec show back up to Jabba's palace.
Which looked amazing.
Looked incredible.
Even the way it was shot with the lighting coming down the stairs kind of mirrored Luke's entrance into there, when you can see the shadow before you see him coming down. It was really beautiful.
It was. It was really, really cool. It's a quick scene. You know, they just come in and slaughter everybody who...
Yeah, seeing Fat Bib Fortuna, I was like, damn, this guy, like, everybody that sits on Jabba's throne, just, like, it's mandatory that they gain 150 pounds or something.
I saw that, and I started having thoughts, like, well, did Jabba look like that at some point? Then I was like, no, that's not...
Yeah, was Jabba, like, super thin when he got on that throne, and then he just gained a bunch of weight?
Well, it does connect to the original plan of Jabba being a person in the original trilogy. So there you go. But how is he not dead? Why did he not blow up in the barge, Fortuna?
I mean, I don't know. I don't think that's ever really explained, but you know, he was always kind of cowardly and things like that. So it wouldn't surprise me if he jumped off if he saw it coming and just landed in the sand or something like that. Yeah, it was really cool seeing Bib again, because, you know, we don't know what happened to him, but as soon as I saw him, I was like, oh my God, that's the dude. Didn't see Salacious Crumb, which makes me very disappointed. And I'm worried that he got eaten by Tusken Raiders or something.
It's very possible. So yeah, so Boba takes over Jabba's throne. The Hutt family theoretically is still around and on other planets, because they're pretty vast in the original, in the prequel trilogy. So we know that there are other Hutts, and now Boba's taken over. I guess the idea is for him to take over Tatooine.
Kind of the criminal underbelly of Tatooine. Yeah. That's what it looks like it's setting up.
It's a cool idea. Yeah. I wonder why they're calling it the Book of Boba. Do you think it's just going to be a limited one season shot?
I don't know. I was wondering that myself. I think it's just to differentiate. They can't call it Boba Fett Show or The Mandalorian, because clearly that last one's taken. But I think it's just a way of naming it something different. Maybe they're going to like frame it as somebody telling the stories of Boba or something, kind of like Princess Bride, where it's somebody like reading these old texts or something in the future. That's the only thing I can think of, because they're going to want to milk it as a cash cow. They're going to want to milk it as long as they can, right?
Well, you would think so, you know, but that's kind of like why I'm curious, because all of the other Star Wars shows are all named in kind of the same convention, you know, Ahsoka, Rangers of the New Republic, Lando, right? They're all named the same thing, you know, the Acolyte. And then here you have the Book of Boba, the Book of Boba Fett, and it's just kind of out of left field. So unless Morrison's going to do that to kind of basically narrate the stories and they're more, you know, mythology than reality, maybe that's why it just seems different.
I'm sure it's like a mini series or something like that, and that's the real reason why. I just want it to be something like it's an ancient text that they're reading in the future of Star Wars, because I don't want everything to take place in this one time period. That's my big complaint right now. But yeah, I think that would be a cool way of doing it, and something different, you know, because right now it looks like all the Star Wars shows are going to be the same kind of storytelling in the same time periods, other than the Acolyte, you know, so whatever. I think that would be a cool way to go about it. But yeah, it's probably nothing that cool. I'm probably overthinking it.
That's fair. In chat, they're saying that it's a 4-episode miniseries. I haven't read that myself. So if that's the case, that does explain kind of the plan, so to speak, because originally season 3 of Mandalorian was slated for Christmas. Now that appears to not be locked anymore. So you could basically spend all of December with Boba Fett and then just start off the new year with Mandalorian.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that seems probably pretty likely. And you know what? I'm not the world's biggest Boba Fett fan. I found him kind of underwhelming, other than the way he looked. He looked really cool in the old movies, and even in this he's been much better, but you know, so I'll watch it. It's not my most anticipated show by any means, but it's definitely a good way of warming up for season 3 of Mandalorian, if that's the way they do it.
That's fair. Is there anything else that you'd like to touch on?
No, I think we covered most everything. I want to say that I loved in the Luke Killbox type scene that there was a lot of very like obvious similarities to Vader's scene in Rogue One. You know, the way he shows up in the fog with the lightsaber lighting up was extremely similar to Vader showing up in that scene. You know, him just going killbox style on all these droids. It was very similar to the way Darth Vader did. Even some of the shots were just like obvious homages to that scene. And I love that, you know, they're father and son. And I think that was a really cool way of handling that. So shout out to whoever's decision that was, probably Filoni or Favreau.
I would imagine. Yeah. That's fair. Do you think we'll see more of Luke, like, for example, in the Ahsoka show?
I, if it's going to look like it did in this, I hope not. It's funny yeah. because, you know, the deep fake, I don't know how much you of the deep fake videos you've watched on
I've seen YouTube a good number of them, yeah.
They've already taken that scene and made it better than what Disney did. So if they aren't going to, like, adopt some of these technologies that people in their basements, you know, on their computer can do, then I don't think they should be doing it. Bring Sebastian Stan in or don't do it at all.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm not sure why it looked as bad as it did, because Disney has pulled off better CGI of de-aging people already.
Yeah.
You know, and
Kurt Russell.
Namely. I mean, Kurt Russell's a good example. Samuel L. Jackson in Captain Marvel, you know.
This was on par with Leia, I think.
I think it was worse. Rogue. I think it was worse.
They both looked equally bad to me. They looked fine as soon as they opened their mouth and start talking. Then it just is completely ruined in my
opinion. Yeah, that when he talks, it didn't match at all, but he couldn't even move his head. Like, at least Tarkin could move in Rogue
Tarkin
One.
Looked better than both of those, I think.
You know, but well, the Tarkin decision for me was weird because I thought I can't remember his name. The actor they got to play Tarkin, I thought actually looked better than the CGI model did. And they should just let him be himself. I thought it was a pretty good recast.
Yeah.
For Cushing. But yeah, I don't know. I thought it was a really odd decision. And if Luke's not going to come back, this is why I'm assuming he's coming back. If he wasn't going to come back, then you could have picked somebody else that would have been easier to look good. Like, you could have just done Samuel L. Jackson and just confirmed that Mace Windu's alive. You wouldn't have had to do anything to him because it's basically real-time aging from the prequel trilogy, you know, and been done with it. And then you never have to see him again, but you can confirm, well, he's alive. And if you ever want to use him, you can. But now you've used Luke. It didn't really look good, but why Luke if you don't plan on using him again?
Oh, I'm sure Disney will patch it and make it look better by mid-January.
Yeah, that's so weird because they did patch the jeans guy out.
Yeah, exactly.
Was it the Siege? Which is an interesting new precedent to patch a TV show.
I wouldn't be surprised if they did that based on how many memes that the weird Luke face has spawned.
Yeah, I'm with you there. But I mean, I'm looking forward to next season, right? I still want to know what's going to happen. I want to know how Din handles things. I want to know what's going to happen with the freaking Darksaber because
it's a left unresolved.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's it. That's it. That's all I got.
I agree.
All right. Well, Rey left us obviously to care for the baby. So her opinion is not in this episode.
Yep. We're just going to assume that she loved everything about the episode and there was no complaints because that's usually what Rey says, is that she loves everything about everything. And yeah, she said that she loved Face Off too before she left. Her favorite Nick Cage movie she's ever seen.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say. Yeah.
So that's great. That we're going to put that on the boxes from now on that they sell a Face Off. It's going to say best Nick Cage movie I've ever seen.
Siren Ray of Screen Heroes.
Yep.
Well, so next week we will be reviewing Wonder Woman 1984, which will be available starting Christmas Day on HBO Max. It's also be available in theaters if you live somewhere where that is a safe thing to do. We will be streaming it on HBO Max. So join us next week to talk Wonder Woman 1984, which is our first big blockbuster movie we've been able to talk about in quite some time. So I'm looking forward to that. You can join us live Tuesday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central on the Heroes Podcast Network page, the public page. That's what we're going to be doing now. Thank you to everybody who joined us in chat. We had some good conversation going on there. Really appreciate all of your thoughts and questions and comments. So thank you. If you didn't join us next time or the time after that, you can. If you can't join us live and you want to listen to the show, you know, that's cool too. We're available at heroespodcast.com and your podcast app of choice. You can follow us at Screen Heroes Pod on Twitter, and please join our Screen Heroes podcast forum on Facebook. We have tournaments, polls, news, memes, spoiler conversations, and all that kind of good stuff. So you can join us there on Facebook as well. You can find Ray at Siren Ray on Twitter. I am at the Star Trek Dude as well. Ryan, what about you?
Buster Props. Hit me up. Let's talk Nick Cage.
Let's do it. Thank you all for joining us. Merry Cagemas. We'll see you next week.